Hello, I'm Douglas Frank, and I'm here with Trish Flaster for our spotlight on members. So thank you, Trish, for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Trish is on holiday as we speak. And tell people where you are.
I'm in Nantucket, Massachusetts. So it's really nice. I can go to the beach in the ocean every day.
And you have the house, the family house to yourself. So you are really on retreat, on holiday.
I rarely do that.
That's great. Good for you. So how is your health?
I'm doing okay. I mean, you never know with cancer what's going on unless you have a CAT scan, and they don't like to give them to you too often because they're radiation. So as far as I know, things are stable. I'll have a CAT scan at the end of the month, and I'll know a little bit more one way or another.
And when were you diagnosed with cancer?
Well, back in 2013.
Okay.
And then it came back 4 years later, and I've been pretty much battling that
on
a regular basis.
Okay. But you were just telling me that you've been able to swim in that, so you're feeling some strength to be able to do these kinds of things.
Yeah. No, I found that one of the best things for me, besides practice actually, is to physically exercise strong as I can. Mm. And so every week it's kind of a build up until I have chemo, and then it starts all over again. So it's fairly cyclic.
Right. Right. So physical exercise is a major practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Really makes a difference on my pain level, my attitude, my ability to do things in general.
Well, it's good that you're at the ocean where you can swim.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Well, that's good. So how did you come into the Buddha Dharma?
Actually, I think the Buddha Dharma found me. It just kept crossing my path in the forms like, you know, I'm going to answer a question before you ask it, which is, I'm an ethnobotanist, and that means the interaction of plants and people. And in my case, you know, how cultures support themselves with plants in the form of health. Mm-hmm. And because of that, someone had approached me to help them develop a Tibetan tea. And so I was working on a Tibetan tea, and then somebody else from Tibet in a Tibetan project wanted me to go over there and talk about sustainable harvesting of Tibetan medicine, because they were working with a manufacturing facility that was really making Tibetan pills, even though it was in China. It was in Xining.
And what year would this have been?
That's a good question. 1996.
Okay. Okay. And when did you become...
97.
And when did you... become a professional in ethnobiology?
Ethnobotany.
Botany.
I got my degree in 83, maybe, I think it was.
Okay.
A master's degree.
Okay. Yeah. So you're going to help with this Tibetan medicine stuff.
Right. So then, and then for the third thing that happened was that a friend of mine, Carol Dunham, if any of you know her in Nepal, who's an excellent practitioner and has lived there, her husband's a National Geo photographer. So they've done some beautiful books in the Mustang area, and they've taken tours up there as well for people. She called me and said, how would I like to host a Rinpoche? And I'm like, yeah, well, why not? I don't know anything about that, you know? Little did I know, right, is the issue there. So this Kampa man came to the house and
in Boulder,
he didn't speak any English. So he had a translator. He was very Kampa, but a very gifted healer, very clairvoyant. He could take people's pulses, and these are people I didn't know. We had a small clinic down in Santa Fe, as well as the one we had here in Boulder. And we go down to Santa Fe, and I literally did not know any of these people. Someone was arranging for us, who I didn't even know them. Anyway, the point was that here was a stranger coming to take the pulse, and he said, so how's your brother? He's in the hospital. And he's going, yeah, you know.
He could feel that in the pulse.
Yeah, and he did that with other people too. It was quite amazing. So that was a great experience. And because of that, I met so many people, mostly from the Shambhala Sangha. And one of those people, you know, I took refuge with this man, Sewang Rinpoche, but it was pretty clear that he was never going to be my teacher. And so I asked people, you know, about it. I tried going down to Shambhala and it just never fit. You know, it was like the wrong size or something. And so I asked a couple people and they said, you should talk to Punlop Rinpoche. And since I was taking this man to Seattle and I was also teaching a little bit at Bastyr, I went there and I asked around, and Rachel Seeley at the time, you know, was there, and I talked to some people there, and I found out that Rinpoche was going to be in Boulder. And Josh was one of the people who actually was coming to see this healer. Rinpoche, he was called the Rinpoche boat. That was not very clear. And I said, could you help me? Because I think Rinpoche is going to be in town. And Brigida was in charge of things at the time as well. So they were, I'm so grateful to them. They allowed me to go to meet Rinpoche, who was staying at Janice's house at that time, and there was a group session, and people were asking different questions. He came to me, and I said, well, I've taken vows, so I have no idea what Buddhism is, you know, and people laughed, but I was like, well, you know, that's the truth. I'm trying to find out what to do now that I've taken the vows, and I said, could I come to your talks? And then he gave me permission, because I asked about being a spiritual friend.
Your voice is fading away.
I'm sorry.
Oh, there you go. That's much better.
Yeah, he asked. I asked about if I could be a student, and he said, "Well, it's more than just permission. You need to know if you want to be my student, and I need to know you as a spiritual friend. You know how it goes back. It's a two-way street." So that was very nice. So I went to the talk at Dzogchen Pottage, and I was like, "Yeah, this is kind of cool. I kind of like everything you're saying, but I." You know, being raised in the congregation that I did is in Judaism, we did a lot of music. And I was thinking this in my head, and Rinpoche goes, let's stop and take a break and sing a song. I joined.
Ah, and what year would that have been?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I really don't remember that.
Okay. But the singing spoke to your heart in some way.
It was the part that was missing in my traditional spiritual training. So that... You know, song is really, you know.
Is there a song that particularly appeals to you?
No. Not necessarily. I like Aspiration of the World. There,
okay.
No, not necessarily one over any other.
Okay. But you like the fact of the Lhana Bodhi Sangha being a singing sangha.
Yeah. It just fit right for me. So, and... You know, you asked how I was, and the thing that's been most amazing is, at least especially from COVID, is there's so much practice online, and so I don't have to leave the house when I'm feeling like feeling bad. Whoops, I'm not feeling well, and so I'm doing a lot more practice, and I'm so grateful to all the sangha members who provide this. You know, in all the sanghas, it's not. I'm on 21 Tars every morning from Seattle, and that's a great. That's a great practice.
Because I know you love Tara.
Well, Rinpoche told me to stop everything and do Tara.
Okay.
That was, and I was attending Tara fairly regularly, but then he said, do that. And so this week in particular, I'm doing Siddha Tara every morning, and that's a gift.
Which is a nice thing, because you love Tara.
Hope she helps me with little Amitabha on her head. So
that's very sweet. Oh, how nice! How nice. Yeah. Is there a Dharma teaching or a slogan that sort of functions as a North Star for you?
You know, I don't know that many slogans, so I can answer in that the thing that I remember and seems to have the most effect on me are the four. The four preliminaries, I think people call immeasurables at times too, because you know, to contemplate the preciousness of being free in this life, and that Dharma will help our passing. It certainly helps our living. So I'm assuming it would help our dying. And creating karma is such a big issue on how we decide our behavior and our view of things. So those things speak fairly loudly to me. And if there's a slogan in particular that goes with that, I'm just not familiar.
But in terms of some Dharma teachings that you come back to, it sounds like this is what you come back to.
Yeah, they have, I don't know, they just always stimulate discussion in my head, you know, about who I am, what my practice is.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. That's nice.
Rinpoche's last talk was quite amazing, and the paramitas, especially. And so I'm thinking about those again, because the definition is different.
Like how so? Like what are you getting from it?
Defining generosity as offering a time. And those who know me and know me in community meetings, I interrupt and, you know, I get impatient. And I think that thinking of yourself as being less or lower so that you appreciate other people, and the generosity of time is part of that inward thinking of mine to look how I might be able to change some of my behaviors.
That's very sweet.
Joyful diligence, you know, dedication and devotion are things that we never can do enough, I think.
Well said. Well said. During this period of time of, well, your illness and, you know, and then we've got the sandwich of COVID on top of that. Are there any activities that are giving you energy, like any passions that you have particularly?
The summer's been great because of gardening. And I often travel for work or meetings or something, and even family. And so being stuck at home has been a great thing in that sense of my yard looks better than ever. You know, things that I'll do next year. So small areas that kind of don't get attention. And I don't know, it just seemed like my garden was in better shape. And I don't know, it's very peaceful to weed. It's contemplative or something. I can go out there for like 20 minutes and weed, and it makes me so happy. And swimming, I really like swimming. So living by the Peace Lake, I try to swim every day. And so those of you who like swimming, this is an open invitation. I'm allowed to bring a couple guests, you know, so.
It's a beautiful lake. I mean, just gorgeous view.
And we clean it. We test it for cleanliness once a week. And
nice.
It's just nice and it's quiet. And it's just a nice view to sit there, and you don't realize you're in a town anywhere. You're by a lake, you know, so it's really nice.
That's nice.
Water's a little cold, but it just, strengthening myself physically and feeling that pull as I stroke through the water and the glide is really nice.
As you describe this, I can feel it. Have you always been a swimmer?
Since I've been fairly young. My mother was a PE professor.
Okay.
And during the summer, she ran some day camps at a swim club. So I was always in the water there. And on our day off, we used to go to the beach. So which is part of our lives. So I've been pretty much swimming since I've been two.
So were you ever a competitive swimmer?
I have lots of trophies, but I don't know. It's kind of like a summer swimming thing. I mean, yeah, I did races, but I wouldn't call that competitive.
What was your event?
I don't remember. I think it was crawl across. And then later on, breaststroke.
Okay. So when you're swimming in the lake, what strokes do you use?
I do a combination of crawl and breaststroke.
Okay.
Because I can't do the crawl long enough that I would like to. So when I need to rest, or if I'm swimming with friends, especially, it's easier to talk when you're doing the breaststroke.
It's very difficult to talk with friends while breathing out. So I've done a little bit of swimming, and there's a real sort of contemplative mind that definitely can be there in swimming.
Sometimes I would do Vajrasattva while I was swimming, you know.
Oh, sweet.
That was really kind of nice out there, because then your movement in your mind, or there was just nothing. It was empty.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. That's nice. So is there anything else that you would like to talk about during this little conversation?
There's so much about ethnobotany. If anyone's interested, they just have to contact me. I've had amazing opportunities to go into remote tropical zones and speak with healers about plants they use, and been able to collect them, dry them, and process them. And so when I travel, I'm so spoiled, because I have like these guides, and they take me, and I do local foods in local areas and stuff. I've never been on a tour, you know, unless it's I want to see. So that's been a great profession for me. It fits so many things. Part of my spiritual upbringing was community, and so developing community, which is the development of the product if it's an unknown herb. And I'm still got a couple projects on that I'm working on as soon as COVID allows. One in India and one in Peru. And so those are working with native people and local communities to ask permission to grow some of the plants that are giving us the active components, one for pharmaceutical and one being ashwagandha, you know, that plant from India.
So my imagination is that you've met a number of shaman type healers in your travels.
Yeah, various.
Yeah.
That Rinpoche that was at my home was one of the more gifted that I knew about, you know, in his clairvoyance. The others, some of them are really savvy. They wouldn't tell us anything. So, are you kidding? We're not going to tell you. What are you going to pay me? Or are you going to develop something with me? You'll just steal the information. You know, I mean, they're pretty wise. They've been, they've had experience with people who have not been too ethical. And so we extremely high ethical codes and guidelines for ethnobotanists that I've actually helped on to develop as well. But the other thing is the work that we did on the end of life practice, our guidelines. Nalanda Bodhi Boulder was so critical in doing that. And there were several of us, Diane in particular, and Carol Ryder was in there, and Dominie, and you know, it was just a really important group of folks that really put that forward. I'd asked permission from Rinpoche, and he said yes. He'd been waiting for someone to do this. And still my hopes are that one of my goals was to develop a container for it. And so that hasn't happened yet. And if anyone knows of someone who can make containers for us, I think they need to be out of cardboard to be light enough and large enough.
Are you talking about a cardboard casket kind of a thing?
No, I'm talking about, I don't have a good name yet. I call it a Bardo box.
Okay.
So that we can put our end of life things, our wishes, our spiritual wills, any gifts that we want to give to our guru or family, our legal power of attorney information, DNRs, things like that can all go in there. And Rinpoche had talked about the design. He has very specific ideas. And it just, I've tried in many ways and I was hitting obstacles, and I'm gonna keep trying. So if people know about opportunities, last time I talked to Rinpoche, he said he knew someone in Malaysia. And so I constantly remind him something.
How big is this box we're talking about?
Depends how many possessions you want to put in it.
So the size can accommodate your possessions, but it has a particular sort of shape.
I looked at it as a kind of a large briefcase or something, you know. I don't think it should be very large. I mean, some people will have hope chests filled with things to share, and I think we need to pare that down probably to something that's fairly simple, but
I like the idea of the Bardo briefcase that you
travel to the other world with. You can take it with you.
The image is fabulous. I love it.
Anyway, it's a great thing for us to have those guidelines. So if people don't have them, they are available and they should be looked at. And I remember learning from you and Ina that it's once a year that you look at those sometimes and review right. them and make sure they're still relevant and that your family members are familiar with them. So I think that's an important part of something we've developed at Milan Bodhi. But the reason about the Bardo box, I didn't really finish my thought there, is that I was really hoping it to be a financial benefit to our Sangha for building and things like that. So if we can get that and take part, just get a percentage of the sales, because certainly it needs to go to Milan Bodhi International and even the bookstore if they're to sell it, it would be valuable for us to get a percentage to put into a building fund. And that's what my goal was.
So this has been a advertisement by Trish Flaster for getting the Bardo box happening and a free bottle of Patron.
Yeah, oh comes. Yeah. Can't see my Patron shirt. I'm highly formally dressed.
If someone out there can make this happen, a bottle of Patron is waiting for you.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. Yeah.
One of the things that I appreciate about you is that you just have this huge heart and you are so community oriented. And this Bardo box is just one example of your offering to the Sangha.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's really thoughtful. I mean, my Judaism upbringing was all about community.
Yeah.
We at holiday times went to senior centers and sang songs and brought food, and we taught, we went to Newark at the time, you know, and did some reading support for some of the kids there. And it was great. I mean, when I was in high school, I went to California as part of it's called the Mitzvah Corps, doing good, you know, and worked in the inner city in LA in welfare, in the welfare unit for a summer. And it was just fascinating. So community is just part of me. It's always been there. My parents were very much that way.
It's in your DNA.
Uh-huh. Very, pretty deep.
Yeah. Yeah. You're Jewish and Buddhist DNA at this point.
Yeah. So I took the vows, and then I came to Nantucket to visit my mom once, right kind of after that. And she likes to go to temple here. So I went to temple with her, and I'm like, what the heck am I doing? I think I'm a Buddhist, but wait a minute, maybe I made a mistake. I'm Jewish. And then they're all talking, and I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. I'm definitely Buddhist. I don't believe in God at all. So it was a really good confirmation to go to temple.
That's good. A moment of clarity, so to speak.
Like a knock on the head.
That's good. Well, thank you so much for being part of this conversation, and thank you so much for all that you do for Milan Bodhi and for the world of healing. Thank you.
Well, everybody takes part. That's all about the Sangha, right? Everybody gives and takes part. So I can't do it without anybody else. So thank you all for all your support you've given me. It's been amazing. You know, when I needed help, people were there. So, and still are.
Oh, good.
So thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your holiday, and may the exercise continue so you feel stronger and stronger. So thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye.